Watch any movie about teenagers, from Grease to Twilight, and there's a pretty standard schoolyard dynamic that you see. There's the cool kids and the nerdy kids, and never the twain shall meet. But my guests today say that the way kids make friends is actually far more fluid than those stereotypes, and they believe even the nerdiest kid can find their tribe with a bit of help. Michael Chambers and Natasha Wardman both teach in the School of Education at the Australian Catholic University, but Natasha's specialty is in primary education and Michael's is in secondary. Michael and Natasha, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Hilary.
Good morning. Thank you, Hilary.
Now, Michael, you taught in secondary schools for 15 years. Did you see that dynamic play out where kids coalesce into the cool groups? And I feel like I want to say daggy groups for an Australian setting rather than nerdy groups, but you know what I mean.
I do, Hilary, and yes, I did see it. And, you know, cool kids and nerds, they're crude terms, but, you know, they're real terms, and most parents and most teachers certainly, you know, relate to them, and indeed most kids in schools. In schools, the cool kids and the nerds, they will gravitate towards one another, and you'll see them in the playground, And whether you're a cool kid or whether you're a nerd, it doesn't mean that you will have those social and relational skills that allow you to maintain and sustain friendships.
Well, are the groupings also a bit more nuanced than we think? I mean, there's the kids who are into sport as well. That can be a whole separate group.
Yeah, look, they certainly are. And it is true. The research would suggest that kids who share similar interests, they will gravitate towards themselves. So, you know, often those kids who are into the cross-country running, they will come together and form friendships. So, yes, we do have those two stereotypes of cool kids and nerds, but it is much more malleable than that. And kids themselves, you know, they're very resilient. You know, they're able to make their way through the school day, and that school day will include, you know, moments of happiness and sometimes some bullying, but they're able to get through that.
I do sometimes feel that we bring our assumptions about social groupings and relationship formation as adults to what kids do. Do those groups stay set in stone throughout a kid's school career, or is movement between them fluid as well?
Oh, they're very fluid, especially in the secondary years. You know, the group of friends an adolescent might have one week might be very different to the following week. You know, social media, I guess, and technology sort of plays a part in that. And most kids in secondary schools today would have a phone, and that is a really important tool for them, and it's an important tool for maintaining their friendships. But it also contributes to that fluidity. Kids get to a point where, you know, they're friends one day and they're not friends the next, and they manage to negotiate that. Eventually, over the years, their groups will sort of settle, and eventually, as you move towards the latter years of secondary school, kids will start to form friendship groups in their own tribe that becomes stable and is often, you know, ongoing beyond school.
Now, Natasha, for your PhD, you went into primary schools to watch the dynamics of kids' interactions. Do you see a hierarchy there or clear groups forming?
Well, I think you're always going to have a peer hierarchy or cliques, and there does tend to be those who are more popular or who have more qualities that their peers look up to. And, you know, from what I observed in my own research, the sportier kids, the all-rounders, those who knew how to get along with the teachers and adults, and who could be social chameleons, tended to be at the top of that hierarchy.
Social chameleons?
Yeah, so being able to socialise with a number of different, I guess, groups with different interests. I've also had a look at some other research which has found that members of select cliques still have a lot of power to define what is considered normal or acceptable within this peer culture. So essentially they're setting the rules of the game. And in fact, being chosen as friends by those of equal or higher peer status has been shown to decrease the risk of peer victimisation. So this whole, I'll vouch for them or they're okay because they're with me, as a flow-on effect. But I would have to say that for kids to be happy, they don't actually need to be at the top of the hierarchy, because they really just, at the end of the day, need to have some quality friends that they can gravitate towards and hang out with.
That's a really interesting term, quality friends. Does the way that we make friends or the kind of friends that we make change over time from the start of primary onwards?
Well, Robert Selman actually has some interesting work on this, and he proposes five stages of social competence that have an influence on friendship formation. And basically, in the younger age groups, we tend to be more egocentric and utilitarian in the way we make friends, where it's all about what's in it for me. And then in the upper primary to adulthood, we start to form more mutually supportive, deeper friendships, moving more from utility or just, you know, using the person for our own benefits to a more quality sort of friendship. And another really well-known theorist in education is Erik Erikson, and he proposes eight stages of psychosocial development, where a crisis is experienced in each stage and will either have a positive or negative impact on personality development. And most kids at primary school age are going through the industry versus inferiority phase, where it's essential for them to experience success in order for them to develop self-esteem and confidence. So if we apply this to friendship, we need to set them up for success in making friends at this time so they are confident enough to do it later on in high school and beyond, really.
So that feels like a big responsibility, that you're basically shaping your children's ability to make friends throughout their life. How involved should parents be? Because you don't really want to be that person standing behind the kid, pushing them forward, going, come on, say hi, make friends.
Yes, that's very true. So, you know, parents do want to help their kids out, and it can go too far though at times. So the main thing I think parents need to keep in mind is not to overdo it with what is often called helicopter parenting or bubble wrapping children. They're quite common terms that we see in the media and also literature, but you know, parents need to be aware of what is going on in their children's lives and in terms of their friendship formations, but they don't always have to intervene. So children actually need to have the time and space to practice introducing themselves to other children, asking them to play, which can then lead to friendship formation. And sometimes the response will be positive, sometimes it won't, but, you know, that's life. Not everyone is going to want to be friends with you for whatever reason, you know, personality or otherwise. And children need to practice how to deal with challenges and rejection in order to build resilience, rather than having all of their problems solved for them by adults or having their parents tell other children to play with them, which is, you know, pretty embarrassing for the kid.
That's true, but I'm also, I guess, thinking of those times when you might notice some children being excluded because of things like body shape or through racism or other kinds of prejudice.
Yes, yes.
How can you manage that so that you're not saying you must go and be friends with this person, but you're contributing to a culture of inclusion?
Oh, well, I would definitely be intervening as a parent or teacher if the child is visibly upset, if they're isolated despite attempts to make friends with different people, or if they're being bullied or actually bullying others. I would definitely intervene, and I would try to facilitate an open discussion with them, offer some alternative suggestions. So asking, you know, is there anyone else you could play with? What could you say or do that might make them more likely to say yes, or, you know, let you join in? Can you find something else to do on your own in the meantime? So, you know, talking through some different possibilities with them, I think, is helpful. I think also parents can definitely teach their children the essential interpersonal skills that will better equip them to make friends. So things like expressing opinions in constructive ways, respecting difference, and caring about the feelings of others. I mean, they're really essential skills that parents can develop with their own children, but that teachers also have a responsibility for explicitly teaching and developing at this in the school context as well.
We're chatting to Natasha Wardman, who's a lecturer in the School of Education and Arts at Australian Catholic University, and Michael Chambers, who's a former secondary teacher and a lecturer too at the School of Education at ACU. Michael, how does having friends or not having them affect a child's well-being throughout their schooling? I mean, having friends is lovely, but does it have wider impacts?
Oh, Hilary, it has huge impact for kids. You know, in secondary schools, we all know kids go there to study, you know, somewhere between 6 and 10 subjects, and they do the arts and maths and English and so on. But sort of the bedrock or the foundation for success in those subjects is, you know, their social well-being. And for those secondary years, and oftentimes it is over a number of years, all 6 or 7 of those secondary years, kids are searching for that social stability. And a part of that is finding really healthy and genuine friendships. And, you know, research would suggest that it's not so much the quantity of friendships that you have, even just having one really good close soulmate, a really close friend, will do it for you. And so that, you know, social relationships is really the foundation of success in secondary school. So yeah, it has a really significant impact on their well-being.
And when it comes to learning the skills about how to make friends, it sounds like a big part of it from talking to you both is emotional intelligence, communication about how you feel and empathy with other people. What are some ways, Michael, that we could teach children those skills?
Yeah, sure, Hilary. Look, I guess emotion identification skills are really critical for adolescents. You know, lots of adolescents, they don't know how they're feeling. You know, they don't know whether the way their feelings are real or whether they're right or wrong, and they spend their time trying to work that out. And so ways that they can work on developing friendships and that emotional security include things like developing skills of confidence, having a capacity to be assertive in your behaviour but not aggressive in your behaviour. Just being optimistic, you know, is a wonderful trait for kids. To have an optimistic outlook on life really helps them in the way they establish relationships with friends. So, you know, also having those basic social skills really does help kids establish really healthy relationships. And of course, for adolescents, if they can have, you know, at least one healthy relationship with an adult, that goes a long way to this emotional security and stability in the adolescent years as well.
Yes, I was remembering Natasha saying the kids that get along better with the teachers have better chance of getting along with the kids. But Michael, I'm wondering what happens if you've got the child that is shy, is not confident and not particularly assertive. If your child is an introvert, can you still help them to make friends?
Oh, you certainly can. And, you know, the family unit is really important for that, or the home life is important for that. Sometimes it requires parents to, you know, firstly have a dialogue with their kids and to openly be discussing how they're getting on with their friends at school and who their friends are. You know, for our parents listening, you know, it's really important to understand and to know who are the friends of your kids. And sometimes it takes even role modelling, even in the secondary years, role modelling with your kids how you might engage with others. How do you introduce yourself into a group? How do you engage in a conversation? What are the skills for, you know, the basic social skills of greetings and saying farewell? You know, those things, they can be learned. And, I guess it's harder for shy kids, but they are skills that everyone can learn.
And Natasha, I'm thinking too of that implementation of things called buddy benches in some primary schools. So if a child is feeling lonely, they go sit on the bench and that's a signal that someone can come up and chat to them or assist them. Is that a useful thing?
Oh, definitely. I've observed in my own PhD research with upper primary students the use of buddy programs. So similar sort of idea. But, you know, they're essentially, the upper primary students, so the year 5-6 students, are paired with kindergarten students, and they're always there for the kindies to approach if, for example, they're struggling to make friends on the playground or something comes up and they're feeling alone. And it also, it's not only good for the kindergarten students, but also the year 5 and 6 students actually find it quite a rewarding experience because it's quite an important responsibility that they have. But yeah, definitely opening that up to all age groups in the sense of buddy benches would be an excellent idea.
And it sounds like it shifts the responsibility for friend making from the individual to a broader collective sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good opportunity for students to be or children to be practicing empathy and as a social skill.
Broader empathy in the school ground. I like the sound of that. Thank you both so much for chatting on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary. Hilary.
Natasha Wardman and Michael Chambers are both lecturers in the School of Education at the Australian Catholic University, though in different states. Michael's in Queensland and Natasha is in New South Wales.